The discourse in the sixth chapter of the book of Proverbs seems a little different from others that we have encountered thus far. We've noted that the first nine chapters of this book are extended discourses on the subject of wisdom, and that the ensuing chapters, from chapter 10 through 31, tend to be more, well, proverbial in nature. There tend to be more short, pithy sayings of wisdom, that these early chapters are intended to encourage us to take note of. And so each of these discourses tends to be marked with the introduction of a statement like, "My son, be attentive to my words. My son, be attentive to my wisdom. My son, keep your father's commandment. My son, keep my words," and so on. And indeed, that kind of phrase is a flag, as it were, to the division between these extended discourses. The difference with the sixth chapter, and particularly the first 19 verses of this sixth chapter, is that they don't hold together in a united kind of theme as most of the other discourses do. Rather, we're introduced immediately to a particular topic, and then in a short space of time, we go on to another seemingly unrelated topic, and then yet another unrelated topic, and so on. Four themes are introduced to us that don't seem to have any direct relevance or tie to one another, and don't have a united theme running through them. Therefore, I've entitled this study that we are to heed wisdom's warnings. For, in effect, what we have here are warnings concerning three aspects of life. They are themes that we will encounter again as we study this book, so I don't particularly want to spend much time this evening looking at this sixth chapter, lest we end up just repeating ourselves later on. Nevertheless, these themes that are introduced to us here are important, and it would seem that this wise parent is particularly concerned that his son should be warned early on regarding these particular areas that he needs to give attention to. The first subject that the father addresses is the subject of loans, or, to be more precise, being a guarantor for a loan, offering up security for someone else. It would seem that there's a danger that this son may end up being obliged to someone else because of a neighbour's debt. We have in the first part of the first verse the neighbour introduced to us. "My son, if you have put up security for your neighbour," it could be translated "friend." In other words, this is someone known to the son, lives next door, or he's someone that he knows well, is in friendship with. And this person has encountered a particular need and has ended up having to borrow money or property from a stranger. But he doesn't have security himself. Should this money be lost, or this property that has been borrowed be damaged, he has nothing to give in exchange to the stranger from whom he's borrowed it. And so he's encouraged this friend, the son, to put up something as security, to guarantee the loan, If something should happen to the neighbour, the son will bear responsibility for returning the item or paying for its cost or refunding the money that has been borrowed. And throughout Proverbs, this kind of arrangement is frowned upon. Indeed, lending at all is seen as an unwise move. The father goes on to describe it as being a snare, using the picture of a fowler. You've been ensnared by the words of your mouth, caught in the words of your mouth. You've made this promise, and at some point in time it has come back to haunt. The advice of the father, in essence, is this: if you can't afford the loss, you can't afford the cost. In fact, the advice given in the book of Proverbs, and indeed throughout Scripture, is if we see a need and we can assist in that need, we should do so. And we should do so freely. In fact, the children of Israel were prohibited from loaning money at interest-bearing rates. Loaning at all was actually not seen as a good thing. Far better if you have the means to give than to lend. If you're expecting and banking on repayment of the loan, you can't afford to make the loan. That's the idea that we have repeatedly appearing in the Scriptures. If there is a genuine need, you should give to it. Here's a neighbour who is in need. Far rather than putting up security for a loan, which obviously the son cannot really afford to do, if he had the ability, he should have helped his neighbour, shouldn't he? So what's happening here, you see, is that this son is putting up security that he cannot afford to lose. He couldn't help the neighbour himself, but he's willing to be bound by a promise to guarantee a loan. As friendly as it may seem, as caring and kind as it may appear, it is an unwise move. And indeed, the father then encourages his son, if he finds himself in such a scrape, he should exert himself to the greatest possible degree in order to get himself out of this arrangement. Do this, my son, he says, save yourself. That's pretty powerful language. You have come into the hand of your neighbour. Go hasten and plead urgently with your neighbour. Plead with him to make some other arrangement with the stranger, to find someone else who is able to actually meet his need without binding so many people under this oppressive agreement. Give your eyes no sleep, your eyelids no slumber. Don't allow time to pass without getting on with this business. You're like a gazelle in the hunter's sights, or the bird in the fowler's hand. Such is the predicament of someone who has given themselves a security when they can't afford to do it. If you can't afford the loss, you can't afford the cost. On the other hand, if you can afford the loss, give to the need. Do it freely, willingly, without expecting anything in return. If it's in your power to provide, then you should do so. 1 commentator suggests that with the underlying spiritual theme that runs through the book of Proverbs, we ought to see more in this than simply the mundane, everyday loan, borrowing transaction that appears to us on the surface here. And certainly the kind of urgency that we have expressed in this passage gives us echoes of the teaching of Jesus, not in terms of lending or borrowing, but in terms of our accountability to God. That we are indebted, as it were, to God for the way that we live our lives, and we will have to give an account of what we have done with the life that he has, in a sense, loaned to us. For the way that we have we lived profitably in his service? Or have we squandered our lives on selfish ends? We will one day have to give an account for this. And Jesus speaks in terms of settling matters with God before that day of accountability, of ensuring that we are right with God. For we know that the debt that we owe to him can never be repaid to him. That we owe him far more than he has given, that we have squandered the gifts and the graces that he has entrusted to us. Give your eyes no sleep, your eyelids no slumber. Save yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the hand of the fowler. Make your peace is the thrust of the message here. Whoever you may be indebted to, in whatever manner you may be indebted. Paul speaks about owing no one anything except the debt of love. Well, that's an echo too of the kind of theme of loans that runs through the book of Proverbs. Give out of a whole heart, out of love to those in need. Don't withhold when it's in the power of your hand to do it. But at the same time, don't entangle yourself in a promise that you cannot keep. The second theme that the Father turns his attention to is that of laziness in verses 6 through 11. And he calls the attention of the lazy person, here referred to as the sluggard, to an ant. Go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer, or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. Here's then a man who is lazy, slouches around, not using time and energy wisely, taking his ease. And the father is effectively saying to his son, don't be like the sluggard. Observe how the ant prepares for winter. Now, scientific studies have demonstrated that what this wise father observed concerning the ants is not perhaps technically true. That in fact there is a hierarchy in the anthill. But when you observe ants, you don't see it, do you? And that's the point. The sluggard is encouraged to look at the ant, see what can be seen. What do you see? Well, if you come to our front door, you see ants at the present time, lots of them, and not a sluggard among them. They're very busy running backwards and forwards, very purposefully. Now, these ants are not the kind of ants that carry leaves 10 times their size, But nevertheless, they are apparently collecting food. And when winter comes, we won't see the ants. They'll reappear in the spring, but for a time they won't be running around collecting food. They've done the job while the food was available. That's the point that this wise father is making. And in a pastoral, agricultural community, this was very important. If you didn't prepare in the summer for the winter, you would have no nourishment. You would have no food. And here's a lazy man, and what's he going to end up being? Well, he's going to end up being hungry, for one thing. But he's also going to be a burden on the rest of the community. For we don't live in isolation, though in our modern day it's far too easy for us to do so. But in days gone by, things were different. Whole villages would be involved at harvest time, with all the men involved in helping one another harvest their crops and bring them in while the sun shone. So there's much more than just the individual that is of concern here. It's the entire community who is affected. And you get a hint of that then in verse 9. There's this call. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you rise up from your sleep? It's as though the villagers have been on a break. Perhaps they've been having their lunch, and this man has fallen asleep under the hedgerow. And he gives no sign of joining the workers as they head back to the field. Indeed, they continue to work away there, bringing in the harvest, and he lies in the hedgerow. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? And he mumbles to himself, a little sleep. A little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. I'll be there soon, as it were. But the father observes that for such a person, poverty will come, like a robber, unannounced, unnoticed. Want will overtake him like an armed man, unprepared. You see, the father saying to his son, in effect, diligence may not make you rich, but it will feed and clothe you. Steady labor may not make you the wealthiest man in the community, but it will put bread on your table year round, and a roof over your head, provision for your family. Don't be like the sluggard, the father is saying to his son. And again, there are echoes of this theme running through the scriptures, and particularly in the spiritual reality of our lives. We think of the teaching of Jesus, and we think about his call to people to follow him, and the excuses that are given. I've just bought a new yoke of oxen. I need to test them out. My father just died. I've got to go and bury him. I'm young. There's plenty of time. I've got my whole life ahead of me. Let me just have a bit of excitement before I settle down to consider such serious subjects. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. And before you know it, life is which is but a mist, will be over. And all that time that seemed to lie ahead of you will have been snatched away. Again, there's that urgency, there's that need for diligence. There's a reality that we face, that we have a day today of salvation. We have a day today to be right with God, to be reconciled to our Creator. We have a day today when we can sort through these issues and get them settled once and for all and be ready for whatever may lie ahead. Today is the day of reckoning in that sense. And if we don't take advantage of today and the opportunities that it affords to us, that real day of reckoning will arrive like a thief in the night, without our preparedness for it. And all of a sudden we'll find ourselves before the judgment seat of God, and we won't be ready for it. We won't be prepared for it. We won't have any resources, anything to call upon, to plead with our judge. And so we need to work today to ensure that we have Christ's righteousness as our covering and his blood as our cleansing stream, so that we can stand before God on that day of reckoning. And God will see us then as perfect, as righteous, because of what Christ has done for us. In the third place, the wise father draws the attention of his son To worthless living. Beware worthless living. So he's going beyond laziness, and he's saying, in effect, a worthless person is a wicked man. One who goes about with crooked speech. There's nothing constructive about it. He winks with his eyes, signals with his feet, points with his fingers. These phrases are uncertain in the Hebrew. Commentators are basically stumped as to exactly what they may be referring to. But the general idea seems to be that there's no purposefulness, in the sense that they make signals, they shuffle with their feet, and they make signs with their fingers, and they seem to look with their eyes, but nothing comes of it. There's nothing, again, that's constructive and worthwhile from all of this winking and signalling and pointing and movement. Indeed, they, with perverted heart, devise evil and are continually sowing discord. And what's their end? Calamity will come upon him suddenly. In a moment, he will be broken beyond healing. You see, this kind of living, whether it be focused upon evil, as seems to be suggested here, or simply is a purposelessness of living, is at odds with what God created us to do. You see, God made Adam and Eve, and he placed them in the Garden of Eden to tend that place, to be fruitful, to multiply, to fill the earth and subdue it. There was purpose. And yes, there was labour involved in their lives, even before the fall. That labour was accompanied by curse. The work became labour by the sweat of one's brow, whereas Before then, it was a constructive labor that was free from hardship. But nevertheless, there was purpose. Adam and Eve didn't simply laze around all day enjoying themselves before the fall. They had work to do. And this kind of worthless person is directly in antagonism to all that God has purposed. He's created us to serve him. And he's created us, furthermore, to do good. And this wise parent is then warning his son, you need to live a constructive life. Your words need to be straight and true and to the point. What your eyes do, what your feet signal, where your fingers point, need to be worthwhile things. And your heart needs to devise what is good. And you need to pursue unity with those around you. And notice that the wise parent is speaking about the whole of the person. He speaks about mouth, eyes, feet, fingers, heart, the whole being. You see, the wicked man is wicked through and through. Or, to use a good reform phrase, he is totally depraved. This does actually lead into the last section of this discourse. In verses 16 through 19, we have a list of things that God hates. There are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him. That's a common signal that we find in Proverbs and in other literature, actually. The X plus one. Six things, no, seven. We'll find them later on in Proverbs where lists are given. It signals to us that this list is not necessarily exhaustive. And it emphasizes to us, nevertheless, that these things need to be taken seriously. Six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him. And then he proceeds to speak about them. Haughty eyes or pride, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among his brothers. Do they sound familiar? Eyes, tongue, hands, heart, feet, discord. What the father has just done is pointed out to his son that this worthless person, this wicked man, is an abomination to God. And anyone then who begins to tinker with these ways of living comes under God's wrath and indignation. Here is an emphatic abhorrence of this kind of lifestyle. But when we take these seven things and read them through the lens of the New Testament, we find ourselves having to say, guilty, 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 guilty. We are an abomination to the Lord. And yet, God sent his Son, Jesus Christ, into the world. And while we were an abomination to the Lord, Christ died for the ungodly. And in doing so, Christ removed the abomination and transformed the object of hatred to an object of love. We have no hope of standing before the Lord in our own strength and by our own merits. Every one of these things, to a lesser or greater degree, in one way or another, has impacted our lives and affected our standing before the living God. And the amazing thing is that despite the Lord's abomination of the things that we have done in our lives, his love for this world is so great that he set in place a remedy. He provided a way of escape from the wrath that we deserve. And that is found in his Son, Jesus Christ. A Son who has put himself up as security for people who would never be able to afford the debt that they owe. And he paid it in full, because he could afford to. And he did so freely. He has worked tirelessly from creation through the ages of history and still works on behalf of his people in order to save them. He is no sluggard, though his work saves sluggards. And his speech and his work in every way has done what is good and noble and right and true, and has done it on behalf of worthless, wicked people to save them from the wrath of God. And what should our response be? Well, our response should be to love, not lend. To do good as far as we are able, expecting nothing in return. For that is what we have received of the Lord. Our response should be to labour, not to laze around. To be diligent in sharing the message of salvation with all who will give us a listening ear. For we have received of that salvation such an abundance that it, however much we share it, our enrichment by it will never grow any less. So we must labour. And our response should be to live constructive lives, not worthless lives. For we have purpose to glorify our God, who gave himself to redeem us, to extract us from our worthless lives and to place us again in a place of productivity and of purposefulness, to take us back to Eden and give us hope. So to love, to labor, to live for the God who has turned his hatred to love and has spared us from his wrath. This is the lesson of Proverbs 6 when we see it through New Testament eyes.